Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is episode 250, and you're joined today by just me, Kane Galanci. Not only me, just for the session, though, as for this very special episode, we're joined by a very special guest, one James Robson. He has a very illustrious and experienced career in loads of elements of data protection, so it was a super interesting conversation. We mainly focused on his time as the DPO for the Labour Party, which is one of his prior roles, and talking about some of the challenges you face in working with an organisation like that. He kind of came in and stepped into the role with a lot of pressure there and already a lot of things to start to clean up. So it was really interesting to see how he approached that and kind of talking about how we work on that broader piece of building culture, how we look and accept risks in an organisation, and as well as talking about, you know, some of the challenges he faces just working in politics in general. It was a really, really interesting conversation. And, you know, we could tell from the chat that everybody was really keen to know more. So really, really looked forward to that one. And just before I let you push off into the session, of course, it is our 250th episode. So I just want to express our collective gratitude at DPP for all the folks who have stayed around for as long as you have. And maybe if you're new to the podcast, you know, hello, and we really appreciate having you. You know, we wouldn't do the podcast if it wasn't for the community that we have. So we really appreciate you guys. And I won't give too much more away, and I'll let you jump right into the session. So we hope you enjoy. Good afternoon, everybody. Happy Friday. And welcome to another episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Little bit of a special episode for multiple reasons, really. The first one being, and I'll give him an opportunity to introduce himself in a mo, is that we're joined by a very special guest today. So we're joined today by James Robson, who has had a very, very experienced and illustrious career in many things, as I'm sure he will probably go on to tell us, in loads of things in particular. I know, namely, in respect to working in some of the highest level of British politics as a DPO. You told me that you spent some time writing one of Wales's first online series. Is that right?
Oh, we're going there. First online drama series before Netflix and all the streaming services, back in 2010.
that's a real claim to fame, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a lot of work. That was 2 years of unfunded guerrilla filmmaking, but we managed to get it onto the Media Wales website. It's like 15 episodes of 2 weeks in the life of a Welsh Asian pizza delivery driver. If you go onto my LinkedIn site and just scroll down. I mean, it's a bit scrappy do, but it's a lot of fun. And if you get past the first couple of episodes, you know, you'll probably lock in and watch the 90 minutes of the 15, you know. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's kind of crazy. I don't think we've ever had anything, anyone in this done anything that impressive, I suppose. that is pretty big to top. And then of course now you lead your own organization, your own consultancy, Datum Longevitas. Did I say that right, James?
Yeah, you did. Datum Longevitas. Yeah, I mean, hey, Latin for the longevity of data, keeping data longer than maybe you would necessarily think you can. But specifically for purposes of reusing that data for research and for enabling your life in better ways. So that's the concept around it. And, you know, I'm still in the early doors of, you know, first year solopreneur at this point, finding interesting data sharing projects, especially with some clients I've got in the research space. That's where I want to grow that, you know, charity and research, to want to reuse the data. And then grow it out to being maybe consultancy around how do you access more data from different locations to do more yourself or do more things on behalf of your organization, but in a very, very controlled way. So it's a managed service provider, but for data sharing. So data sharing managed service provider is the concept, a trusted data intermediary. But it's going to take some time. Yeah.
Interesting. No, but it's all super interesting stuff, to be fair. And I definitely want to pick it apart a little bit, as well, of course, as some of the stuff in relation to the political elements, which I know we want to talk about as well. I'm sure people would like to hear about. I suppose the other reason this is a pretty special episode for us is it's our 250th episode of the podcast today, which is crazy. It's crazy for numerous reasons. One, because nobody else from DPP is there to celebrate with me. I've got no Kay, no Miles.
It's a massive achievement. That's actually incredible. I mean, it's right up there with the 250th birthday of the United States, you know, exactly. Hand in
What's
hand with the podcast.
You know?
The podcast. Yeah, without a doubt.
Exactly. Oh, I have Tina here. Thank you, Tina. But no, it's great. And, you know, I appreciate that I've only been, you know, probably what is only really a small part of the broader stuff, maybe only like 50 odd episodes potentially, but you know, we've had many presenters. I'm sure some of you will remember some of them. You know, of course, Phil, who we don't see too much of these days, but he's still very much cracking around doing his thing. Ollie, Dave Holmes, Joe Kirk as well, Jasmine. If you remember any of those guys, obviously big part of the podcast is thanks to them, and of course a massive thanks to you guys for giving us such a fantastic community and something to turn up for every week. So you know, we're really glad to be, and I'm very glad to be celebrating this milestone with all of you guys, and hopefully next week when Miles and Kate are here, we can maybe celebrate a little bit more properly. But you're right, Charlotte, Phil is too busy making his coasters. He's busy making all sorts of things. He's busy doing all sorts of stuff. He's a very, very busy man, is Phil. But I suppose on that note, as you know, a little bit of self-promo for DPP aside, is there any sort of introduction that you want to give yourself, James, in terms of before we head into the session, we talk a little bit about politics?
Well, I mean, staying within data protection, I've been doing it for a decade. Started out as one of the early GDPR consultants, and sort of just grew through the industry as the industry got bigger as well, and jumped in and out of big organizations. And I got my first DPO gig, must be kind of almost 5 years ago now, in something called the Evidence Quarter, which is what introduced me into the research and data sharing for research, really. And it was from there I was about to set up what I've set up now, a consultancy to try and become an intermediary, a trusted data intermediary. And then I got the Labour gig, and so that was 2.5 years of my life before I've spent you know, a good 6-8 months doing my own thing. But that's a bit about me here.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And of course, the fact of being a DPO for such a large political party, it's super interesting, and you know, it's a side of a coin that we don't really see so often. You know, for me, I'd be so intrigued to get to, you know, with respect to not going into too much details, I imagine, but to just kind of understand what that's like and what kind of challenges that can present, because it does feel like in terms of the realms and sectors of what I've worked in, probably all come within similar issues, but probably some really different and out there stuff as well, I imagine.
Yeah, it was quite an extreme experience, especially in the data protection realm, because, you know, I walked in thinking they had a data subject access request problem, even from the outset and in the interview, which, you know, it's all very exciting. And then to realize that they didn't have a DPO for 2 years before me, and they were still suffering the fallout from a data breach from 2021, which is well documented. You can go find it, and they essentially lost access to their membership database in 2021, so they couldn't draw down payment for the members, which is how the Labour Party funds itself. And it came kind of teeteringly close to the Labour Party not being able to exist because it can't afford anything because of that breach as well. So it's incredibly effective, but they had to change all their systems. And it turns out they haven't answered data subject access requests for 2 years, or a deletion request for best part of 2 years. So I just walked into that carnage. I mean, to give you some stats of that, you know, I basically walk into a burning building, not realizing, it's a burning building as much as it was. There were three major breach investigations from the ICO, 70 ICO complaints that were open, that were unanswered. Wow. And then I started to find all of the unanswered DSARs and deletion requests, and then found a new inbox privacy at labor instead of data protection at labor that they hadn't necessarily told me about within my first 3 months, to find about 10,000 unopened emails and having to get through that. Gosh. So the journey was carnage, and I might as well be open with it. I mean, nothing I'm really saying now, you can't easily Google and find information about it, but it, without a DPO for a couple of years, it atrophied, and I had to kind of raise the flag and advocate for better protection of data throughout all systems within each of the departments. And so became really, really enthusiastically friendly with all of the sector, or all of the stakeholders in each of the business units, if you can call it that, really. And then started to be able to turn the ship. But, within that sort of high pressure environment, it's almost that I didn't even have time to really learn how it all worked before I'm firefighting. Sure. All the laws around why they're allowed to process so much data as they do either. And it took me kind of between three and six months to then find time to sit down and start to read through, okay, why are they compliant? Why is this legal? What are they doing? Mm. 42 million records on the electoral register. What are they doing with that? All that kind of wonderful stuff. Yeah.
That sounds really, that's really quite intense, doesn't it? I mean, you mentioned a few key points. I think there's a few bits that I'd like to pick on, but I suppose starting from like towards the tail end of what you were saying, you were mentioning, be the smiley sort of, that voice of sort of reason and for someone to come to, and kind of in shifting that culture, I agree that it's something that is ultimately so important. How do you feel like that sort of shift in the behavior of you as a DPO being that sort of shining sort of light? How do you feel that kind of adapted the business's approach to data protection, being that it seemingly was something that looked like it had been pushed to the wayside for a couple of years? Now you've come in and, uncovered this can of worms, frankly. How do you think you went about trying to improve and adapt that culture?
Yeah, go to the socials, get to know who the heads of department are. Things like, if we've got a supporter list that is supposedly consented for political marketing, then who is the owner of that type of list? And there'd been a blog written about, it was actually called Labour's Grubby Little Data Grab, and it was written by John Baines, who, if anyone knows John, the chairman of the National Association of DPOs and Freedom of Information Officers, and NADPO. And just as I, like the week before, I had a coffee with him, because I'd reached out after that blog he'd released, and I said, okay, what am I walking into? And so I kind of found the owners of the systems, and because I just wanted to learn more, they were worried that I was trying to debunk what they're doing and tell them they're doing it wrong. And the couple were a little bit defensive, but actually, if I don't know how it all works and flows, then I don't stand a chance in the first place. So it was more just being friendly, having a coffee with them. How can I help? What issues do they think they're facing within compliance, within the compliance around how their data is being used, and had a series of meetings. Luckily the Labour Party did pay for my travel to the different offices around the country, so I could go and sit with the different departments and get to know people. And they were really helpful in facilitating those introductions, so I could get to know it, because they were worried. They were worried about getting a fine from the ICO because of the non-response to the DSARs from 2021 and things.
Yeah,
so,
it's
and, yeah,
it's interesting, is that, because you know, two years without responding to SARS, did they have to deal with the ICO in any kind of respect in that period of time, or was it only really within that period of you sort of taking over data protection matters that these things started to come to light?
No, they were having monthly meetings with the ICO for pretty much the 12 months before I got there, because you know, it takes sort of, go back 2 years, it takes a while for the ICO to catch up with whatever's going on. Sure. There'd been over 100 complaints about it already, and they were in a cycle of, like, every month the director of the governance and legal unit and head of legal affairs would be having an online chat with the ICO and whoever they'd hired some external data protection support to try and get through the backlog, and they were meeting, and I just walk into that and I just thought it was complete carnage, and the language going back and forth between the legal unit and the ICO, I'm like, good luck not getting a fine with that kind of language. And
oh, really?
Obfuscation tactics that were being used. Wow. So much so that within the first couple of weeks of me reading through that stuff, I'm saying to my line management, I'm not getting you out of this fine, and I'm also not going to go down with the ship. My career is not going to fail here. So you can imagine the amount of work that then went in to even just grab hold of that. I mean, they didn't have a DSAR process, they didn't have a logging system properly, they didn't have a feedback or a notification email template or anything. There's just nothing there that was managed in any sort of easy capacity. So it was just hard graft walking straight into that.
It sounds like a good bit of work. I mean, I think if that were me and I was coming into that, God knows how quick I'd probably be handling if I noticed I'm running away, to be honest with you. That sounds terrifying. But how do you even begin to approach something like that when you got hold of this thing and you got under the hood and you go, right, we're working with a lot here and there's so much, where you know, they've got no process and procedures, there's clearly no logs, you not got a lot of evidence for writing a lot of things. How did you get started? What did you take as sort of, this is my first action kind of thing, apart from obviously some of the culture bits we were talking about?
What was the first action? I think it was some of the letters from the ICO that weren't just about the investigation into the DSARs. There were other things going on that I can't really allude to too much. And I'm like, oh, there is a deadline, and the deadline is next Tuesday, and I only started last Monday. And they're like, oh, have a look at this. And that first weekend was my first overnight in the office, straight through the weekend, and being quite an intensive personality, trying to grab enough information to write a report to go to the ICO by 9 a.m. on the Monday morning. And I worked like very late every evening that week, over the weekend, and then overnight on Sunday, just so I could make sure I hit that deadline. Because what I did get a real sense of was the ICO had their eyes directly on labor, and we needed to change the feeling that the ICO had about labor. I mean, it was obvious. All the communications I was looking at, I'm like, they just think we're doing it completely badly and wrong, and we need to change that relationship. And within a legal environment, generally, there's a defensiveness around those kinds of interactions where they're just trying to hold off the regulator. Sure. And again, once I, you know, even pulled that first sort of weekend and overnight things to at least get something tangible over to the ICO, I said to my boss, like, we need to bring the ICO close, like super close to us, and then be transparent about all working processes, and then develop it with them in our faces, essentially. And I remember my boss saying to me, it's like, yeah, but we've just spent 2 years trying to keep them away.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I feel like there's a little bit of a habit of organizations maybe taking that approach where sometimes they want to keep the regulators as far away as possible. And I think that's valid. And hopefully they should stay as far away as possible in most cases. And you won't have to deal with them that much.
Yeah, they should have a requirement to feel that they need to keep the intensity and the pressure on an organization. It shouldn't be that in the first place. Yeah.
No, for sure. And I think it's like, but when it gets to that point where there's so many eyes on you, you've kind of got no choice but to adopt that kind of mindset where we have to be as transparent as possible and we have to work to keep them close and to keep them sweet. And it must be, you know, to when something's so obviously looked at from the ICO and when something's a little bit, I suppose, more sort of public in relation to so many complaints and there's been, you know, the things written by John Baines, there is that pressure, isn't there, that comes with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ICO are always looking for, I suppose, people to make an example of. So it must have been, you know, a little bit of an upwards battle, I imagine. It's pretty impressive that you know, it came out on the back end of it all okay. It must have been some long nights, I imagine.
Yeah. You know, many long weeks and months, and I think that first year was incredibly trying. You know, overall, you know, many weekends just taken and gone. But you know, I started to get into rhythm with the ICO and got to know who the complaints unit department were, and then got to know who the government department and the guys there, and became friends with them. And they started to invite me to some of the ICO events so I could get closer again. And I put together one thing I thought would be important was to actually talk to other people who understood the challenges of data protection and political party. And I brought together the DPOs of all of the political parties. And so we started to meet monthly. So by the end of sort of 2023, because I started in sort of August 23, we were meeting monthly. So it's Conservative, Plaid Cymru, SNP, Liberal Democrats. And we did invite Reform and the Green Party, but they never got back to us. But that was quite instrumental, because in one of our first meetings, I managed to blag a legal firm's boardroom that happened to be in the Gherkin, and the ICO came to give us a presentation to that group as well. And,
oh, wow.
And they really liked that. And it ended up getting to a point where they were okay with me using the ICO as a bit of a bat phone. It's like, this is going on. I just want a quick chat with someone that will understand it. And just sort of used whatever tools and leverage I could to make my life easier.
Sure.
You know, and also make double check myself and that the regulator was on side. Yeah, no,
100%. I mean, having a pipeline to the ICO must be pretty nice. I'm sure there's probably a few people in there who probably think, God, I wish I had that every time I have to speak to them and it takes me ages. I know I was speaking to Carl Rose at the we had an event, DPP hosted an event last week.
Yeah.
I can't believe that was last week, feels like ages ago. But we were speaking about that. It's like, oh, I just wish the ICO would get back quicker and stuff like that. And it's a common pain point, but if you can have it, it's great to have, isn't it? And I think there's a real key point that you touched on. And I do want to talk
about it. I've had a reply this morning, Kane, and forwarded,
oh, have you
forwarded
now?
It to you.
Oh, I see. Well, I will be picking that up, Carl, very, very promptly after this.
As you were.
Thank you, mate. It was, you mentioned a really key point on community and having a network. And I think it's kind of great that you can see some kind of unison in political parties. Maybe it's just the DPOs, but I guess that says something, doesn't it? That there is that element of coming together. And I think that's real, really, really key, no matter what element of data protection law you work in. And I want to talk a little bit about reform, just because there's some elements I heard in the news in relation to some data protection bits at some point as well, and just sort of get your thoughts on those. But I do think that community is massive. You know, this is why we have the podcast, this is why the podcast exists. And we always encourage that, you know, no matter what sector you're in, you find like-minded individuals, no matter what it is, whoever it is that you feel comfortable with sort of having a chat with and working with. It's invaluable, isn't it? Just someone who knows what you're going through and they can just sort of be like, yeah, I've got 5 minutes for a chat. Or, you know, we get a lot of new customers through the door through that same kind of method. You know, people are talking stuff through and you know, they end up through our door because of oh, we had this experience with DPP because we had a similar case. And, you know, even if that's not the end goal and it's just, you know, maybe just having a moan about a very similar issue. Maybe if you work in housing, it's about disrepair claims, maybe back in the day when those were a little bit more prominent and stuff. But that community is so key, isn't it? And I think it's important, no matter who you are, what you do, no matter like how maybe easy or difficult you find the job, I still think it's such an invaluable asset to what you do, because it is it's a pretty lonely field at times, or at least it can feel like that for most, I feel.
Yeah, in an in-house role, when you are kind of almost at battle with all parts of the organization to make changes, you know, maybe battle is a bit firm and a bit strong, but yeah, incredibly lonely, because you're the one going, there's this thing, it is illegal. If people find out, it could end up, especially in a political environment, being in broadcast media and used against in a political way. And you're the one making this discovery, and you've got to raise it with the general secretary, which is essentially the CEO of labor. And even to the point where I'm going over my line management's head when they're the ones saying, no, we need a solution before we raise the flag and let's slow this down. And I'm the one there going like, no, we can't slow this down. I know we don't have a solution right now, but I know we need a decision immediately, because this thing is now a raging inferno, hotter than the sun. This has to happen. And to be fair to them, I've made it sound like it's all doom and gloom and crazy. Labour went on board. They totally were. And they made some major changes and updates because of the recommendation of DPO and holding that level of, I guess it is authority, but it's got to be trusted. And
sure.
You can't press that nuclear button like too often. You know, you end up crying wolf too much and they just won't listen to you. Or if you are obstructive to what is their main goal, which is to get as many people voting for them as they possibly can.
Sure.
To get into power, that is the reason the Labour Party as a party exists, to get into power. If you're getting in the way of that, and you're not trying to find a solution around that, if there's a problem, then, you know, you will lose trust. So it's almost aligning to the party, but still the organization, to make it a bit broader, but still going, there are people underneath this information that could be harmed and, you know, could end up receiving information when they don't want, could be aggrieved if their people think that they vote a certain way when they don't want anyone else to know. Where are the pain points, the human points of concern that could have somebody completely aggrieved or anxious or even so emotively motivated to take action against another person, which it's the political environment. I mean, you know, look at the murders that have happened of MPs within the last number of years as well. I mean, that is a, you know, where are they, why are they there, personal data and being used to detrimental effect to find them and for somebody to take action against them. So, you know, all of that stuff. I mean, I got very, very close to the director of IT and security.
Sure.
And she was amazing, absolutely amazing, and still is. She's no longer with the party, but, you know, it was a hand-in-hand daily communication to go, this system here, I'm saying this, what are you seeing, what are the logs, and then what the changes that I felt needed to happen, and then her either working through them or finding an alternative or kind of building a use case or a reason for the change and making a case for that. So you know that was sort of a daily basis, but really, the business as usual was an enormous influx of emails from the general electorate, from people just being upset with the party and sending everything through from death threats to, let's call them love letters, that they physically write and post and tell you you're a bonehead. You know, so, you know, all of the above, really. Very, very bizarre.
Yeah, it must be a mental thing. It must be absolutely crazy. I could only imagine how many sort of plates you have to juggle. And you make the point about the implication of the stuff you're doing potentially being in the public eye, and that in itself is a pressure, isn't it? And maybe you do feel that pressure to act in certain ways because of it. And you know, you raise a point that I was sort of, you know, really agreeing with in respect of when we're saying that, like, oh God, I've actually forgot my point. That's not ideal, is it? Let me see if I can round it back up. Well, we're talking, there we are. We're talking about the risks in terms of, we got data protection risk and we have risk to the business, don't we? And I think to be a good DPO, you've got to understand both, and you've got to have that balance of what both are. And you've sometimes got to expect that we're going to see instances where exactly what we want won't go to plan, because at the end of the day, a business has to run. It has to run in a way that is going to succeed. And sometimes that might butt heads, and the best DPOs are people who can kind of bounce around that, and they can be flexible, and they can still find a way to do both, or to, you know, sometimes be a little, you know, give a little bit of leeway, sometimes be a bit harsher when they need to. But you've got to take that mixed approach, haven't you? And you've got to be able to understand both. Just having a mindset for one or the other is going to be a difficult game, you know. So it's one of those things that you definitely have to consider sort of long term. I mean, one of the things I wanted to touch upon, James, and you know, I don't know if you really do have any really thoughts on this at all, but a couple months ago now, I'd probably say a couple months ago, there's a bit in the news swirling around in relation to reform, and in relation to a data collection in respect of a raffle that they were doing. So they were doing a raffle, I don't know if you've seen this, in relation to paying an individual's energy bills for the year, right? And in doing so, they were asking for collection of data in relation to who you're planning to vote for, essentially. And, you know, when we had this episode and we discussed it, we were talking about, you know, some of the concerns in relation to that, you know, considering it is special category data, considering the implication of the collection of that data as well, and that I'm fairly certain, I might be wrong, but I'm fairly certain they were relying on consent for the collection of the data, which just seems wholly wrong, in my opinion, and just not even remotely compliant with the requirements of Article 7. I just wondered if you have any thoughts on these kind of things, and if this is kind of like a routine thing. I've never actually seen anything like this before, any sort of incentives to sort of disclose political opinions and voting habits.
So, again, within my first 6 months of being at Labour, they were spinning up a lottery. There's a Labour lottery. And I did a DPIA for that and worked through the contractual measures and things. Now that works. And yeah, Labour also have a raffle and a tombola, and they give away a car. And within some of those, I it was a while ago since I worked on it, maybe kind of 2+ years, but I would say, yeah, they were probably asking which way an individual was thinking of voting as well, so then they could match that to the electoral register and add it to their copy of the electoral register up against that individual as well. And political parties are allowed to do that. The Representation of the People Act pushes it into democratic engagement purposes, which in the Data Protection Act of 2018 then aligns it to public task, public interest in GDPR Article 6. So, like, you go down that stack of where that gets to, you're allowed to ask those questions legitimately, and it's legal to do so. Now, the consent mechanism would be around whether or not you're going to then send them marketing material to encourage them to vote. Mm. Now, interestingly, within democratic engagement purposes, you are allowed to encourage people to go out and vote to increase voter turnout. Mm. You're not allowed without consent to try and persuade them which way to vote. So you may get tons of emails if you've kind of put it into any of the political parties around you know, especially if you're in Makerfield at the moment, going through the Andy Burnham by-election, loads of emails just saying, don't forget to vote, you know. Mm. little neighbor sign, you know, whether you consent it or not. So it's trying to make it not a, this is our policy, this is what we're going to do, this is what we're trying to persuade you to vote a certain way. That is the consent requirement if you're going to try and persuade somebody to vote a certain way. So, yeah, it's a very fine balance, because you end up going like, well, anything that's got a logo on it, surely that's political marketing. And I'm like, well, yeah, sort of. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a further... by definition, the answer is it isn't. But then you've got this further angle, which is something called IPSA, which is Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, where MPs and candidates for the parties have to uphold certain standards where they can do casework on behalf of maybe a constituent to help them and solve a constituent's problem. But they're not allowed to then use that individual's contact details for their own political marketing and political messaging, because then that's breaching IPSA standards and IPSA rules. So you're like, oh, and there's another split there. So you've got the, democratic engagement is allowed, but then you've got IPSA rules and you've got the consent mechanisms for political messaging as well. It gets quite convoluted quite quick and quite difficult, because that means you've got to chop somebody in half and go, well, half of me is doing this. But surely from the fact that they are a Labour MP and they are helping, surely that's screaming a bit of marketing and advertising of Labour, and they're saying, I did this amazing thing for you.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm Labour. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm persuading. Yeah, how do you... It's a real fine line.
That's difficult, isn't it? Because I suppose everything a political party tries to do is in respect is promotional, isn't it, to some regard? So. Yeah. It's hard to sort of argue otherwise, but the law is quite clear in respect to what it considers to be direct marketing at the very least. But then you get your own additional challenges in respect to the other standards and requirements that you have to sort of work by.
That's it.
Did you find that was a challenge in itself, having to, you know, consider probably other elements of the law that most organizations will never really have to consider that might be quite complicated? You know, I can't say I've ever looked at anything in relation to law for political parties in respect to data protection law. So I don't know if it comes with wholly different challenges and rules that were quite difficult to adapt to.
Yeah, I think the balance between helping people in casework and then not really being allowed to shout about it as a political party that has helped you. I think that is definitely one of the challenges. I think there were extremes of challenges over and above other organizations that are sadly normal to political parties, like just enormous spikes in DSARs to political targeting, where people are trying to be difficult to disrupt the democratic process through continuous messaging and emails to any external facing email they can get their hands on. And you find there are people that are politically motivated that are known throughout the party because of the volumes of contact that they make, and so much so that some of those people were well known to most government departments and authorities because of the bombardment and continuation of contact. It was quite astonishing.
So I'm presuming that you go through periods of time where you get massive spikes in sort of subject access requests. I know that you said that you had obviously like a significant amount during the period of the 2 years, but presumably around times where politics is more discussed within certain areas, and when things like general elections are coming up, does that also influx the amount of data protection issues that you were or could be dealing with?
Yeah, I'm absolutely right. So I've told the story a lot, but and it was publicized, the Good Law Project and the Open Rights Group on the 1 month until polling day in 2024. So on June the 4th, knowing that polling day was on July the 4th, 2024, they launched an easy to fill in web form that auto requested a DSAR from all political parties, and they sent it out to all of their members and as wide as they possibly could. And on the 4th of June, 2024, I started receiving the data protection inbox within 2 hours, 200, 2 days, 2000. And it just kept going upwards, you know, bearing in mind, you know, very strategic timing within the 30-day, you know, 1 month window. And that was incredibly trying. I mean, that was basically, you know, any curiosities of learning more about general election were over, and that was all I could deal with. And I then pulled on communications with the rest of the data protection group in the other political parties, just say, are you seeing this as well? Let's get on the phone with the ICO and things. So the spikes are significant. That one was the most significant, and is dependent on what is going on in the country. If somebody has said something that has blown up in the media from one of the political parties, or somebody suddenly disliked, or they get fired, then you'll see a spike in various types of contact. Yeah.
Wow, it's really interesting. I suppose obviously you of course have loads of obligations, you know, in relation to the EIR and the FOIA and stuff as well. I imagine those will also come with potentially even more complications, just because of the scope then of the type of requests you can get even more. So I know the FOIA has been in the news a lot recently, maybe more on LinkedIn if you're on LinkedIn a lot, because I know that the ICO are making some interesting decisions in respect to what they've been disclosing in the FOIA and stuff like that. But I presume it's a similar thing to political parties, where they're getting maybe even more FOIAs than SARs potentially, or maybe not.
So political parties are unincorporated institutions on Companies House, and they're not subject to freedom of information. Okay. And it was one of the requests that we'd get regularly, and you know, we just got template email that we're not subject to freedom of information. Make further contact if you need to. So I was very glad to get that pass. Sure. As well.
Yeah. But I guess you get a lot of tryers then, irrespective.
Absolutely. I mean, all political parties are allowed to send postal campaign material during any election, and they don't need consent to do so. And also all political parties, because of the Representation of the People Act of 2001, they're not required to get consent to access the electoral register either. Mm-hmm. But even if you've opted out of the electoral register, does not mean that stops political parties from having access to your details and they're allowed to use it. So, you know, if I had £1 for every time somebody complained about receiving things through the post and they hadn't given consent, or I'm opted out of the electoral register, how have you got my details? I didn't give you consent. And that was a regular complaint that will come through via the ICO as well, and both the ICO and ourselves had to put up FAQs about it.
And I suppose that is sometimes part of the issue is making these things publicly aware and widespread enough that the hard thing with data protection and information rights, I guess, is that it is easy to misunderstand, and without that sort of further education to constantly feel that data is being used in a way that is inappropriate. And then that's a hard ask, and it's a hard ask for a DPO or for a business to put enough out there and to try and make it sort of understandable for all, you know, why the transparency principle exists. Obviously, I feel like sometimes there's an element of people only going so far, I guess. Maybe there's instances where if it is a little bit more technical, you could try and go further in some instances and help. But it is a difficult game, because the amount of people that read and consume these things is quite limited, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, other curiosities that were seem specific to political parties were things like, you know, having individuals that weren't of good character, let's say that, but love politics, then moving between the political parties as members, and you know, depending on how much of a bad character and some like horrendous things, think of the worst type of individual you would want anywhere near any children. And within the political party, are trying to ingratiate themselves to the local constituency, but then being found out in one party and then moving to the next. And so there were some kind of very difficult situations there. I mean, to give you an idea of the level of concern around some people, you know, the Labour Party hired before the general election, they hired the ex-head of safeguarding for the Catholic Church and the ex-head of safeguarding for the Methodist Church, you know, and I was sitting next to them and hearing some of the things they were having to deal with, which is horrendous. But then data protection, the data sharing bits and bobs that have to go into that for the protection of, you know, vulnerable adults and children, it is absolutely real. And then there's the, no, ask me another question. There's so many things.
No, I'm 100% sure. I'm sure there's so much more that we can probably pick apart on this topic. What I am wary of is I'm wary that we are just about out of time, but okay. Before I let, you go, I'll let everybody else jump off for their Friday, James, is any sort of closing thoughts that you want to add? And as well as that, you know, where can the lovely people in the community find you if they want to know a little bit more about you?
Sure. Yeah, LinkedIn is the place for me. I post every day and I try to keep it kind of as topical. My passion is about data sharing. How do you make that a lot easier? Leaving thoughts. I mean, I'm a true believer that almost all uses of AI or uses of data or platforms, our job has become so integral throughout everything. Charlotte, I will talk about owls and there's a scroll up to the top. I think that's just noticed that coming in.
Yeah, it's a regular
side that's distracted me.
It's a regular theme of the podcast, that James, don't worry.
The owls, yeah.
Totally. Just the odd animal fact every week.
You know, I just want to be an advocate for our industry because the importance of what we do will grow to a level of significance I don't think we even understand properly yet. We sure. will pick up the AI governance piece. We will be instrumental in reducing the duplication of data to almost single sources where we have our own digital identity wallets. But I'm sure. not talking about the government ones because that's quite contentious. I'm talking about us having agency over our data to share it with different services and companies, and we have the agency over that and control over that. At the moment, the balance is not right. It is more in the favor of the organizations, no matter what organizational type they are, and that needs to shift. And we're going to oversee that, really, so people will have more power over their data and have more agency over it. And you know, it will possibly become monetized in some way where we can recoup some of the money that is being made from our data by those organizations. Now there needs to be a redress there, and we're right at the forefront of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Some really great points. Honestly, James, I feel like we could have gone on forever, so I very well may be in touch and getting a part two for this setup. I think that would be very intriguing if you are interested, of course. But you know, on that note, guys, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have a lovely weekend, and of course thank you so much for James for joining us as well, and thank you for being with us for 250 episodes now. You know, we really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll see you in the next one.
Thank you, Kane. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
James, take care.